So my paper this morning is part of a book I'm working on about reciprocal work bees, and one of the chapters will focus on food. The book is focused on these work bees themselves, but also is giving me an opportunity to try to understand how neighborhoods worked internally. So generosity, generous hospitality was a key ingredient of neighborliness, and the feasts at these work bees is a prime example of this. The feast was the first installment in the payback system for the free labor that neighbors had provided. It was an integral part of the exchange. It was like the icing on the cake at the end of the day. The promise of a good meal attracted people to the work bee, and then the food itself helped fuel their energy and enthusiasm for the work to be done. The feast also reinforced neighborhood standards of hospitality and could accordingly advance or damage your reputation, depending on the kind of feast you gave. People, I'm not sure how they felt about nutrition. It's difficult to understand their understanding of nutrition, but they did know what foods made them feel full and what foods gave them the stamina to continue with the hard physical labor. Everyone was expected to do their best, even if it was a modest affair, and in small communities, people knew how much you could afford. So to live in a commodious home and only serve your guests pork and beans on the lawn just wasn't up to the code of hospitality. So my paper argues that the feast was a foodscape of abundance, and I want to look at the setting, the service, and the food as all part of a performance that reflects wider community customs and aesthetics. And one of the most important points for this paper and the book is that the feasts represented a delicate balance between meeting what others expected of you, and that was basically your best that day, but also without overstepping neighborhood standards. Because to deliberately show off or outdo others promoted rivalry and bad feeling, and it struck at the very heart of neighborliness, at notions of fair exchange and equality and economy. In short, it could complicate the willingness to work together in the future. So to understand feasts, I have used nearly 100 farm diarists and their writings. They rarely recorded the mundane meals they had, but when it came to a feast like this, they would often have something to say. I've also augmented this source with memoirs because people remembered the feasts, fondly remembered what they had eaten and stories that emanated from those special days. Not all bees had a meal attached. At barn raisings, there was always a meal because too many people attended to return the work to all of them. There were usually 100 to 200 men at a barn raising, and so the feast and festivities that followed were an important part of the payback system. And the meal represented the climax of the day, as you can see with this illustration, with the feast being the central picture. Threshing bees also nearly always involved food. The men would come with their threshing machine. They were hired by the hour, and they would stay until the work was done. So hostess often had to provide breakfast, lunch, and supper. And sometimes that went on for more than one day if the work went slowly or the machine broke down. Sometimes women would have a feast after a quilting bee. Note who the host, who is a server in this particular picture. But usually they went home after their work to feed their own families. Feeding the hungry hordes took an awful lot of planning, as women attempted to command scarce resources, food, space, equipment, and labor. In the months leading up to the event, they might have a sheep fattened up or make some preserves and have them set aside. But most of the cooking and cleaning and trips to town had to occur within 3 days prior to the bee, in the days before refrigeration. And many of these bees are held in hot months of June and July. So keeping the food in good condition was a challenge. The magnitude of some of these occasions is rather astounding. Here we have the diary of Gertrude Brown. She had a barn raising, she and her husband. 23 came to supper the day before the barn raising, and then they fed 200 the day of the raising itself. So she baked 65 pies, 125 tarts, 20 cakes, one fruit cake, 120 buns, three hams, and 35 pounds of beef. Enlisting the help of others was obviously necessary. Catherine Partrail, writing in 1854 in her book Hints on Canadian Housekeeping, said that the loan of household utensils is always expected at the Bee. And so people would borrow pots and pans, forks and crockery, and she advised that people count them carefully so there would be no misunderstandings within the neighborhood. And the diaries show this happening on a regular basis. Anne Amelia Day of Wellington County borrowed, along with pots and pans, she borrowed butter and buttermilk from her sister-in-law because they didn't have a cow. Mr. Sinclair of Howard Township, he had to borrow a kitchen and a cook for his house raising because he didn't have a house to live in. The setting was important too. The priority was to provide protection from the elements as people ate. So that might be the hot sun in July, or bugs on a summer night, or cold and rain during the harvest season. In an evening on June 1837, Mrs. Webb invited her guests into her log cabin following a chopping bee. She had made a makeshift table out of a plank supported by sacks of corn, and she'd made some chairs out of bags of wool and a broken ladder. But it was so crowded that evening that the men jostled for space amidst her cooking pots and the tiny room filled with smoke as the men enjoyed their drinks and their pipes. So there was no transitional space between the dirty work and sanitary eating, between the hot, congested cooking area and the dining area, no separation of private and public. By the late 19th century, a separation was becoming evident, especially with the barn raisings. Most of the time at barn raisings, people were fed outside. So they cooked the food inside, then transported it outside. And you still wonder about the dust and dirt there in that particular image. And then usually there were some buckets provided for the men to wash up before they came to the table. By the early 20th century, a lot of the farm homes had a summer kitchen, which was a place that they put the cook stove in the hot months. So they could do their cooking there, and then the men, the threshers in this case, could eat their meal in the cool main kitchen. Serving the food was part of the performance, especially at barn raisings, where as many as 50 young women, usually unmarried women, bedecked in white aprons, would deliver tea to the hungry men while their mothers, their older women, worked way back in the kitchen. Photographs demonstrate this. This one is a formal photograph taken of the servers at a barn raising, and you can see that the women dressed up, that they starched their aprons, put on nice dresses, and that they bedecked their table in a similar fashion with linens, maybe not their finest linen, but with linens and flowers. The women always, the men always ate first, and the women served them. And the men generally sat in a democratic kind of fashion. After the men had eaten, then the women would sit down. So you can see that this is at one barn raising. The top picture is the men eating, and then the switch has occurred by the bottom picture. Men ate with a heartiness that reflected their hunger, and also the need to get back to work fast. Now, etiquette experts in the late 19th century urged people to mask appetite in its raw form because they thought it was really disgusting. So they advised people from rushing to the table or eating hastily or licking their spoons clean. Such niceties had no place at the work bee. The winning team got to race to the table and they attacked the food. In 1837, a traveler remarked how the men at the chopping bee ate in a take what you have and you won't want fashion, and they kept their straw hats on. the issue, basically, if you didn't eat quickly, you'd soon find that somebody else had eaten your cherry pie. When it came to the food itself, women had strong opinions about what and how much should be served and what constituted a respectable table. And the men would report back to the women at home as to what they'd eaten in other places. These are newspaper reports from Puss Lynch Township. There were 50 such barn raisings written up in the Puss Lynch newspapers, and over half of them had something specific to say about the food that had been served. Usually it was complimentary, saying that the food was sumptuous and abundant, that the tables fairly groaned with the best of everything. I think that would have been a very stressful time for women to know that you might get written up in the newspaper. Maybe you were inclined to be competitive, which would give you a certain kind of stress, or if you couldn't bake that cherry pie, or if you didn't know how to organize things, it must have been a very stressful period. The key components of a respectable table were plenty of meat and home baking. Extra fancy Victorian dishes like molded desserts or even a fresh tossed salad were not wanted at the harvest table. Men wanted their hunger satisfied quickly. They wanted a familiar hot meal, even in July, and they wanted to be fortified for the next round of work. So meat was always the center dish of the feast. But what was fitting meat to serve changed considerably over time. In the very early days of settlement, most of the time it was salt pork. If there was a fresh game or fresh pork, that was a treat. If the pioneers had cattle, the cattle were being used for their milk and their work, not as meat. As the livestock variety and supply increased in the mid-19th century, mutton came to be the meat served at bees. And they'd often say if they saw a sheepskin hanging on a fence, then you knew that a bee was going to be held. By the 20th century, with the growth of beef and dairy herds, beef became the meat of the feast. Beef is a high prestige food. It represents a lot of capital investment. And so to serve it to your guests is a real mark of respect for their help. But slaughtering your own animal in 3 days prior to the feast was almost impossible given all the other things they had to do. So it came to me as somewhat of a surprise that they either borrowed the meat or they went and bought it. So William James of York County in 1880, in his diary, we have him going and getting 22 pounds of beef from a neighbor before his thrashing, and he promised that he would provide this guy with meat when he held his thrashing. But most seemed to go to the butcher to buy a choice piece of beef. It's interesting that chickens don't appear at all. Chickens were not feast meat. They were valued for their eggs, and if you serve chicken at a feast, it looks suspicious, and people thought it was a tough old bird. Except for purchasing meat, all the other food was homemade, and women made their tastiest dishes in an effort to show their respect to the workers and to meet the twin dictates of thriftiness yet generosity. The versatile potato was everywhere. A Mennonite cookbook from the 1950s, recommended 10 gallons of mashed potatoes at a barn raising for 175 men. Amidst the rather bland fare of meat, potatoes, and gravy, and seasonal vegetables, condiments were the special thing that added zest. They also added a personal touch, and most women had either a jam or pickles or something that was considered to be their specialty. So they might become known for their 7-day pickles. Even in the early days, people expected a sweet treat. Before flour was readily available, this usually was rice pudding. They purchased the rice and the currants to go in it, and it could be easily boiled up on the hearth. If flour was available, they might make fruitcake or plum pudding, and these two items could be stored for weeks in advance. But pie. Pie comes to be the be-all and end-all of these harvest meals. The most popular and certainly the most memorable food item at the feasts. Pie is a very social food. You can cut it up into however many pieces you want. And they recommended that for these bees, you only cut it into four pieces, maybe five at the max. So we're talking abundance. Those are pretty sizable pieces of pie. Pie is also easier to bake than cake. And once you get the crust done, you can set it up in an assembly-like fashion, invite your sisters in, and wham, 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 you put different fillings in each pie and you get variety. It also doesn't need to be refrigerated and would keep up for 3 days at least before it got to taste a bit stale. Most pies were made of seasonal fruit, but by the 1920s, more exotic pies are starting to appear with improved food transportation. So women would delight their guests with lemon meringue or coconut cream or pineapple pie. And Eva Wilson did this through the 1930s at her thrashing bees. And then when her daughter grew up, got married, and had thrashing bees in the 1960s, she added to her pie menu cherry cheesecake. But it was made with Philadelphia cream cheese and canned cherry pie fill, and she made it a couple of weeks in advance and put it in her big chest freezer. Men really looked forward to working at a place where the food had a good reputation. And thrashing crews were known to slow down or accelerate their work to influence the location of their next meal. Exceptionally poor or great meals, exceptionally slovenly or pretentious behavior rapidly made it into the gossip mill and soon became stories that were retold to entertain, to confirm aesthetic opinions, and act as cautionary tales. Many of these stories get repeated in the oral interviews and local histories. A poem from Simcoe County decried the use of dried apples in apple pies, and it went like this. Upon a dirty cord they're strung, and in a garret window hung, and there they serve a roost of flies. Oh, don't pass me dried apple pies. Other stories are told of hosts being caught out for being stingy or for being uppity and essentially having to eat humble pie. So a story is told in Wellington County from the early 20th century of a family that moved there from Toronto. Without understanding that beef was what they should serve at these events, the hostess served up sliced bologna. And the story ends in a didactic fashion, noting that nobody ever came back. Another story by John Marshall, who was born in 1904, he recalled a woman in Mono Township who was prone to putting on airs, as he called it. And she bedecked her table with her very finest linen. And so the thrashers, when they came to eat, decided they would teach her a lesson. They skipped the wash basin and wiped their hands, their filthy hands, on her linen. And the story suitably ends with the uppity woman never showing off again. Over time, standards concerning sanitation and variety in menu rose. Stove cooking replaced hearth cooking, sealer jars, ice boxes, then refrigerators, all meant that work could be reduced, improving, and the storage improved, which allowed for a greater variety of foods. But the abundance of foods was usually limited by kitchen space, appliances, help, and finances. At a certain point, the cost of feeding workers could outweigh the benefits of the free labor they'd given you. And the work was hard for hostesses. By the early 20th century, farm journals encouraged women to avoid killing themselves in preparation for the thrashers, to try to keep things simple. The periodicals suggested that during World War I, that men should bring lunch pails to reduce women's work, expenses, and the waste of food that was left over. In some parts of the American Midwest during World War I, they formalized thrashing bees. And part of the formalization involved men having to pay a certain amount of money per meal, and also rules established as to where the next meal would be. So if work stopped at 10:30, the meal would be there at that farm, or would it be at the next farm? So they established rules like that. I haven't come across these kinds of feeding alternatives in Ontario. Here, thrashing meals seem to continue as part of a tradition, and a worldview was present, expressed by one interviewee who said, and he was still attending bees in the 1960s, I quote, "Anyone who doesn't think enough of his neighbors to give him a meal once or twice a year isn't much of a neighbor." So women may have had a different point of view, and this suggests they might have. Women may have dreaded the workload, the derailment of their household agendas, the scrutinizing eyes, but at the same time, memoirs seem to suggest that they felt proud of their cooking and their local reputation, that they respected the tradition of cooperative work and the labor of their menfolk, and that they valued their own and their daughter's role in what was the climax of the day. Thank you.